Today we have four amazing panelists that are going to talk about motives. That's right. What happens when our motives are selfish, and how to see if our motives are clean. First, I would like to introduce Lauren B. from L.A.
Oh my God. My name is Lauren, and I'm an alcoholic. How long am I speaking for?
20 minutes.
Fabulous. Grateful to be sober, grateful to have all you guys as hostages now for 20 minutes. This is my show. Just kidding. So thank you for asking me to be of service. I really appreciate any opportunity to participate in my sobriety. I am not one of those people that like immediately, yes, I will do this. Like, I would love to be of service. Anytime you need it, like, I'm here. That's not really in my nature. When I came here, I was full of fear, and the most terrifying thing that you could ask me to do was to get up in front of people and share my story. Yeah, fucking right. I'm not going to do that, you know? I mean, no. Not unless I have, like, a bottle of Jack in me, and then I've got the mic all night, you know? I guess I will tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I mean, Paul Hughes, I can't wait. You know, I grew up in this household that it was pretty normal, if you can define. I don't know what normal is, but I think everyone is dysfunctional to a certain extent. But we had a very nice house, and my sister's sitting here, so she can tell you that I'm telling the truth. It was interesting because we were sitting at the Thanksgiving table a couple of nights ago, and our housekeeper was talking about how aggressive I was as a child. And, you know, I had vague recollections of sort of, you know, beating up my sister, you know, throwing her down the stairs, playing the burrito game where I'd wrap her up in a blanket and just pull her down the stairs. And this was my invention at 5 years old, like how to have fun, tie her up, shoot hockey pucks at her face, and stuff like that, you know? I mean, that's, Lauren is muy agresivo, that's what she said. you know, and, for me, like, that very, it ties back to motives, but for me, that very idea that, like, someone else was stealing the spotlight from me, that self-centered, egocentric sort of part of me that every alcoholic has, that this person came into my life and ruined it, because I was getting all the attention, I loved my life, and then she's born. And I think I took a sword to her when she came home, and I said, put her back from where she came from. My dad told me that. So that landed me in therapy, and I've been in therapy a long time. It's funny because now I'm a therapist, but I've been in therapy a long time, and I was trying to figure out for a long time, you know, what is wrong with me? Why do I feel so... not a part of, you know? Why do I feel like I always stand out? I always felt like that. Even in our family, I just felt like I don't belong, you know? I'm not skinny enough, I'm not pretty enough, I'm not this enough, I'm not that, and drugs and alcohol just filled that void. So that's like the beginning of my selfishness and self-centeredness and that sort of underlying thing that drives basically the rest of my actions, and that's what a motive is. It's like this, the intent behind the action. So what am I doing? Like, why am I doing it? And it was because, you know, she was taking the spotlight from me. And as I got older, things changed, you know, like my motives changed and they become a lot more elusive in sobriety. But anyways, when I was 13 years old, our mom just disappeared one morning. Packed her bag, moved to another country, gone. And it was a horrible experience. It was terrifying. I didn't know what it was like to be without my mom. I mean, I was 13, China was 10. And I'm in the middle of my adolescence. I mean, asking my dad like for a tampon was like the worst. Like it's just like, no, I'm not doing this, you know? And I remember just separating myself and isolating a lot of that time. And as my mom moved out, drugs and alcohol moved in. And I've always been like sort of the one who like pushes it to the extreme. I mean, I was like the 13-year-old who like, you know, was the first to smoke weed, and then I remember I got like a crew at my old, it was an all-girls school, I mean, can't be that hard, but I literally had like 7 girls, and just thinking about like seeing 13-year-olds now, like because I work with them, I do therapy with them, and thinking about like, yeah, I run shit, you know, it's like me in that position, it's hilarious, in my uniform, you know, and at that point in my life, I literally went from smoking weed to putting needles in my arm at 14. And that's just the progression of my disease. And I wanted to feel different. I wanted to be a part of. And when I did drugs and alcohol, I felt acceptable to myself. I felt like I could look myself in the mirror, you know. I still struggle with, like, these very, like, core like sort of defects about like I'm not good enough and that self-esteem and stuff. And what I've realized is that if you set goals in sobriety and you achieve them, you get self-esteem. And my sponsor says to me now today, like you, those goals cannot be like outside of yourself. Because for a long time I thought, okay, if I get the right boyfriend, I get married and I have a kid and I recreate my own family, that'll be great because then I've got my own family and it'll be wonderful, you know. And I'll live in Orange County, and I'll wear Uggs, and push a, you know, sparkly and I'll be in a juicy sweatsuit, and, like, everything will be fine. But not the case. Anyway, so now let me just try and get sober as fast as I can. Sorry, I'm all over the place, but this is kind of how I talk. What happened for me was that, it got really painful. I went to the school, University of Colorado in Boulder. That's where I got sober. And things just got buck wild, like, all over the place. And, you know, I was that girl that slept with your boyfriend. I was that girl that backstabbed you. I was that girl that talked shit about you, stole your pills. I mean, I remember I had one roommate. I stole her pills, and she got mad at me, and so she was in the shower, and so I just went in the shower and knocked her out, because, like, I was like, that's how I handle stuff, you know, like, when you're not looking, like, boom, you know, and, yeah, that's how I handle things for a long time. I ended up in the emergency room quite a few times. You get it, you guys get it, like, I'm an alcoholic, I'm a drug addict, that's what happens, and, for me, I had this moment where, like, everything else had failed, and so I decided to go into the program, and my sister actually got me hooked up with some girl, and I ended up going to this meeting, and there was 800 people in the meeting, and my life changed from that moment. That was December 22nd, 2004. I haven't had a drink since. I haven't had a drug since. I haven't found it necessary to. And I've gone through a lot of shit in sobriety, like a lot of stuff. You know, I thought losing a friend was hard in sobriety. You know, breakups are hard as well. and doing things that you don't want to do sober, you know. I just kind of going back to the whole motive thing. A lot of my motives in early sobriety, like, were to seek attention, to seek validation through other forms of alcohol. You feel me? Like, men? And I remember it was all about, like, okay, they told me to show up at the meeting. Arrive early, and you're going to do 90 meetings in 90 days. And I thought to myself, I don't have 90 outfits. How am I going to do this? You know? You know, it's like, I'm going to have to reapply makeup, like, a lot, you know? It sounded very tiresome. And then as I got some time, and I remember getting that 1-year case, realizing sort of the spiritual side of the program that I could never wrap my brain around, you know, outside of sobriety. the most incredible thing that I've gotten in this program is a connection to a higher power. And anything that cuts me off from that higher power, you know, usually has to do with those defects of character. For me, lust, greed, sloth, wrath, anger, hello, you know, the whole gamut, like, of those seven deadly sins. As a newcomer, I was extremely defiant. I would just say that, like, Harry, is it T? I don't know his last name. He used to write about alcoholics a long time ago. And he said that an alcoholic is characterized by a grandiose and infantile ego. And that was me. That was me in the beginning. I just was not humble. I didn't know how to be that way. I wasn't parented that way. How you tell me to do something, I tell you to kick rocks. Get out of my face, you know? That's not my nature to take direction. And what I got was this ability to sit, be quiet, and listen. And it was the most amazing experience once I was able to sit in a meeting, not text on my cell phone, not be distracted by the people in the meeting, and listen to the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because when it comes down to it, this is the most amazing, beautiful program that you will ever experience. You know, you have to give it a try if you have not tried it. And imagine if drugs didn't work quickly. You know what I mean? Like, you would be like, fuck that. And I know a lot of newcomers think, like, I'm not getting the results quickly. But for me, I'm more of like the educational type where I gain the results over a period of time. I know I'm not really staying on the topic of motives and what have you, but I will tell you that my motives today, I wouldn't say they're all in like a very pure place, you know, let's be honest, but I have the ability to slow it down now, where I can actually think on stuff before I actually do it, and I can run it by my sponsor, and I was like, you know, Naya, I have this brilliant idea. I am thinking about going over to his house at 3 o'clock in the morning, knocking on the door, and seeing if he's up, you know. And she's like, Lauren, why don't you pray about it? Why don't you do some writing about it? You know, why don't you get quiet about it? And I love my sponsor because she talks about meditation is not optional. The 11th step is not optional. It's not extra credit. And to me, that is a very important thing. That's a very important component of the program. I grew up Jewish. I never prayed on my knees. I don't know how to, like, say the Lord's Prayer and all that. I just, you know, this whole thing was foreign to me. I didn't know how to get a connection with the higher power. I don't even know. Like, I remember questioning, what is God really? You know? And she tells me that God lies within you. It's that fundamental idea within us that we all have, that God is within us. And, you know, these miracles have happened through my life. I talk about a lot of bad stuff that's happened to me. I have before in the past, but now I'm going to talk about all the wonderful things that have happened to me, and I have like 1 minute, so I will try to make it quick. But the most incredible thing that ever happened to me in the program was my sister getting sober. 100%, you know. when she came to me and said, I need help, you know, I was sober and I was able to be there for her. I was able to show up. And it was the most amazing experience because I'd seen this person dying before my eyes, you know. I tried to knock some sense into her, like, Beans, you're yellow, you're 90 pounds, like, please, stop, you know. And now, you know, she's coming up on 4 years of sobriety. It's the most miraculous thing in the world. And that, to me, is worth everything. All the pain, all the heartache, all the stuff that I've walked through, everything, like, that connection that's in this room right now, that's in, within each one of us, that's what I found, so... Thank you so much for letting me be of service.
Thank you, Lauren. Now. now, I would like to introduce Richie B.
Woo!
Richie Alcoholic.
Hey, Richie.
Well, thank everyone for being here. Lauren, thank you for speaking, and our next speakers, and especially Paul H. from L.A., comedian, front row, front and center. That's Paul. 25 years?
Wow.
This thing works. Let's see. You guys can't tell, but I'm actually wearing Uggs. they work. If you don't have a sponsor, just buy some Uggs. Let's see here. Before you tune out and I lose you, I want you to know that I love my life today and that Alcoholics Anonymous is the cause of that 100%, and this program works. I know it through my own experience, through watching those around me. I've stuck around a little bit and have witnessed many people who I didn't think were going to make it, and they stick around, and it's a trip. Just to let you know a little bit about who I am and where I come from, I am from West LA, and I grew up on the West Side, and I was born. My mom was 19 when she had me. It was a month after her 19th birthday, and her parents kicked her out. They said, if you decide to keep it, you're out, and it is here. So she was out. They dropped her off at St. Anne's Home for Unwed Mothers, and that started our journey. She likes to joke and tell people that I was a welfare baby. No, it always makes me happy. But it was bumpy. We moved a lot. We just kept moving. We just kept, you know, it'll be different here. It'll be different. I went to three different first grades. You know, I went to, by the time I was in high school, I think I had been to something like 15 schools, something like that. Just because we just kept moving, you know. And people would ask me, are you an Army brat? And I'm like, what's that? No, I have a single mom. She's rad. So I learned how to make friends quickly, but I didn't get attached. I'm not big on opening up. Somewhere along the way, I found alcohol. I looked up to the male role models in my life. My mom, it's tough being raised by a single mom who's so young. She did the best she can. You talk about asking dad for a tampon. I remember my mom teaching me, like, I had to go to the bathroom. She would just say, go in there and make bubbles. I'm like, in her head, she explains it now. You know, like, boy, there's a stream and it makes bubbles. You know, like, love your mom. Love your mom. She's my favorite person on the planet. I love her. We're so tight now. We were always tight. My mom tucked me in until I was 15. Thanks, Mom. I wasn't allowed to have anything that resembled a gun. All my friends had G.I. Joes. I couldn't even have those. No super soakers for me. No video game systems that would rot my brain. Mom said, you know, she gave me books and stuff, and she gave me an Easy Bake Oven. That's always rad. You know, your friends are like, hey, let's go play war, and you're like, I'll make brownies. Soldiers get hungry. But it was weird, and somewhere along the way I found alcohol, and for me, alcohol wasn't what I was looking for right away. You know, being 10 or 11, was somewhere around that first drink, I don't remember the first one, but, you know, it wasn't instant. You know, it took practice, actually, for alcohol to work for me. I didn't arrive and everything just made sense that first, and that's, everyone has a different story, and alcoholism shows up in different ways. You know, our stories vary. But for me, it took practice. And the first time it burned, it didn't taste good. I was a 10 or 11 year old, so I was a Kool-Aid Tang kind of kid, you know, and alcohol was not those. Just tasted very funky. But as I said, I practiced, and I learned to love it. You know, I learned to make it taste good. The book talks about I drink for the effect produced by alcohol, and that was my story. I drink to get drunk. Now what I thought was everyone did that. I look at my mom. My mom was, because she had me so young, she turned off. She opted out of all of that. She tried a couple things here and there. She drank minimally. Still does. Very rare when she drinks. and she may or may not finish her glass. She didn't think about it. She might have a second. She might not have any. And it just, I mean, it just baffles me that this is with my mom. Like, I came from this woman. Because for me, it's my primary focus. That's all I got. That's all I'm worried about. And so things progressed. You know, I used to do well in school. You give me a number 2 pencil and a bubble test, I do pretty well. I don't have to try too hard. I do well in sports. Popular. I was like president in high school a bunch of years and just knew everyone, and yet felt so lost, so disconnected. The book talks about a spiritual malady, and for me that's just simply just a disconnect from my fellows and something greater. You know, I don't come from a place where we believe in something greater, and I wasn't raised with religion. I think my mom was pretty afraid of it because of her upbringing. They went to church a lot, and grandma and grandpa were twisted. You know, you're having a kid, you're out, and that was hard for her to understand. And you know, and so that whole idea of believing something was strange. But anyway, so things go the route they go. I get jobs, I have relationships, I get fired, I break hearts, I have my heart broken, total cars, I am a weird guy. I don't know about you guys, but I go from point A to point weird. Like, that's just, it's where I'm aiming when I drink. I guess everyone's different. You know, somewhere along the way, I don't know what happened to you, but like me, somewhere along the way, there's like, they talk about that line, alcohol, it had ceased to become a luxury, it had become a necessity. And I understand that. I've gone to the point of no return. I am now a pickle. there's no going back. Right, Nick? but at that point, somewhere my clothes became very restrictive when I drank. I would drink and all of a sudden my clothes felt very tight. So I gotta take them off. And I'm like the weird naked dude. And I'm sweating a lot because that's what I do. I'm good at sweating. I like sitting still and being very tense. I just don't want to move. That's kind of how I get down. I buy the expensive bottles of wine from 7-Eleven, the $7 Cabernets. I'm a red, whatever. I would drink about 5 of those, 6 of those in a setting. I've had this tail end of my drinking. I hit this on the corner of Oxnard and Woodman in the city, the lovely city of Van Nuys. Beautiful place. There's a bar there with a red light out front. I knew when I moved in, I'm looking and I see this place with a gas station right there. That's my bar. 2 apartments away. If things get bad, I can crawl home, you know. This bar, I get in there, I order my Jack, I get a Pacifico Chaser, because it's just how I get down. Just start, you know, they had TV. It was on mute, but they had TV that worked. They had a pool table that was 50 cents, and a jukebox that was a little rough. A lot of K.D. Lang, some Indigo Girls, a bit of Britney. They did have one Sinatra CD, but it was the duets, which was a little tough. There was like one for my baby, one for the road, was with like Kenny G or something. It was awful clarinet, just slaughtering, you know, Sinatra. But you make do, you know, this is my bar. For better or for worse. I'm getting dirty looks as I get in there. The woman behind, I know there's a lot of flannel. A lot of bandanas off. I'm like, and those women are kissing. I was like, I was in a lesbian bar. I don't know if you can tell by looking at me, I'm not a lesbian. So I was instantly not liked. It was the, what are you doing here? You are the opposite of us. This is not for you, and you're in our place. And by the end of it, I was family. And that's just what happens. I get in there and I say hi, and I just become part of it. And I loved it there. The Oxwood Inn, and everyone's name was Connie. Everyone's name was Connie. It's Connie's birthday. I was like, wasn't it Connie's birthday like a month ago? And they're like, no, different Connie. The weekend bartender. I'm like, oh, okay. I'll be there. Whatever. But that was the end, and it wasn't amazing. It wasn't this spectacular, you know, explosion of it's time to get sober. It was trial and error. I was tired. I ran into a friend of mine at a coffee shop in West LA that I frequented for some years, and he's my best friend growing up. I hadn't seen him in some time, and I said, "Hey, you want to go throw a couple back?" And he says, "Actually, I don't drink." Like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. You know, he must have something wrong with him internally. Like his innards must be broken or something. Because we're the same age. We grew up. We robbed houses. We ran with gangs. We tagged. We were taggers. I tagged Peanut. Like not spelled out. Like actual Peanut. I thought it was very clever. On my agent. I was pretty tough. In my head, I was like 6'5", 220, and I could hold my own. And in reality, I was this little pale, like fresh-faced boy, just with like a bowl cut, you know, in an Easy Bake Oven. He said, "Yeah, I'm an AA. I'm an AA." I'd heard those letters put together before, but I really didn't have a second thought. You know, I didn't know if that was a good thing or a bad thing. I kind of took that it had something to do with not drinking. And he said, "You know, I don't take anything that affects me from the neck up."
Who talks like that? Are you okay?
very confused. He goes, "Don't worry, man, that's not for you." I was like, "Excuse me? What, I'm not cool enough to be part of your neck up club, you know?" And it was the perfect 12-step call on me. It was the perfect way to approach someone like me. Had he said, "You should come and join me," I would have freaked out and said, "Get away." But he said, "It's not for you," and now I want in. I gotta get in. Somehow I gotta get voted in. I didn't really want it that bad. I sort of let it alone, you know. Fair enough. It had nothing to do with drinking. I'm out. You know, no thanks. But after some months of hanging out, he kind of noticed that I might be a candidate. And so he duped me into my first meeting, which was a 7:30 a.m. meeting on Thanksgiving morning. Actually, it just passed. Wow. This was 98, I think. And we had been up all night. He was sober the whole night. We were partying in Hollywood. It was a log cabin. Lovely place. For those of you that haven't been to the log cabin at 7:30 a.m. in West Hollywood, that's a chipper bunch. They are super duper happy. They are not just alcoholics. They are grateful, recovering, suffering from alcoholism, but treating an alcoholic. And everyone has a sweater on their dog, and they want to tell you what latte they got. And I'm like, I don't care. You're freaking me out. I was wearing a bright orange shirt that said, "I Heart Heroin." That one got mixed reviews. Not too many people like that one. That shirt's a trigger. I'm like, my shirt's a trigger. Like the part of the gun? They're like, "That could cause someone to get loaded." I'm like, what's with all the gun references? Trigger, loaded, you're a bullet. whatever. that was the beginning. And he said it wasn't a cult. He said, "Hey, it's not a cult." I said, "Okay, I'm keep an open mind." Then the first person got up and said their name, so-and-so alcoholic, and everyone goes, "Hi, so-and-so." And I was like, what do you mean not a cult? He's like, everyone just chanted his name. And I sort of chalked that one up. I was like, okay, maybe he's just popular. Maybe everyone knows this guy. You know, whatever. The next person gets up, they're going to read chapter 5. Chapter 5. I'm like, chapter 5. This is creepy. And they go, "And see, God could and would if he were someone." And I look at my friend and I'm like, "Are you kidding me?" It's like, just chanted about God. And he goes, and he's doing the whole pump the brakes thing because the meeting's going on and he knows I'm about to loop it. And he's like, just chant. And I was like, "They just chanted about God." I was like, "Look at the dictionary. That's a cult, man." And then they did this thing where they said, "There's no dues or fees," but then this basket starts going by. And I was like, no, he just said there's no dues or fees. Wait a minute. And I'm thinking, this is some Jedi stuff that I'm just not privy to, and like I'm not smart enough to wrap my head around that, but that's some reverse psychology. I should have went to college. I just wasn't down. I was so freaked out. I didn't stick around. The time came. The cool thing about going out, though, is alcohol and its friends will beat you up quite enough to either bring you back or kill you. Put you in jail, just ruin your life more. For me, I wasn't the type to go to jail. I never got arrested for anything drug related or alcohol related. Health wise, I never ended up in the hospital. I was pretty lucky, you know. For me, I just lived miserably. I think that's the one that's missing. You know, jails, institutions are death or living miserably. And I hate myself, I pick my face, I sweat, I'm naked, and I freak everyone out. And that's the future. that's as good as it gets, kiddo. You know, I got a sponsor, I started getting into this thing. I come to find out that this is a 12-step program. The meetings are definitely part of it, and they're a lot of fun, and I meet some people, and every so often we, you know, do some necking, and we go to dances, and eat food together. Crazy. There's a book that goes with the program, and I had to get into that with someone that had been through it before, and we started highlighting stuff and defining words that didn't understand erstwhile. I don't know if anyone here has used the word erstwhile. I say, what, in your lifetime? I don't use words like erstwhile. So I have to look them up. There's a lot of words I don't know. You know, part of not going to college is not knowing what aggregate. It's funny, I sponsor guys now. We'll be reading. So far, the aggregate of recovery is resulting. I'm like, whoa, slow down. Aggregate. Do you know what that means? And I'm like, yeah, it's the total. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I know. actually, I have that written here as well. It also says that it's the sum of. The sum of. Go ahead and write that down. Come to find out, sobriety was a trip. I thought I could hear some things enough times and repeat it and start to look good around here. And I can be going through the book with a sponsee, going to meetings, having commitments, and still be a complete scumbag. Who knew? The most I've been given here is humanity. It's a set of principles that I can choose to pick up. And a lot of the times I don't. Let's be real. Part of humanity is imperfection. I haven't transcended the human condition. I haven't learned how to levitate. When I fart, it doesn't smell like Chanel. Every so often I still check. No walking on water here. A lot of the times I like to look good in Alcoholics Anonymous. I like to get service positions and you know, say the right thing, share that one thing that makes everyone laugh or make you think. And, oh, I've never heard of it like that. You know, just really look good in AA. Boy, you give me an hour, hour and a half in a meeting, man. Set up, shaking hands with new. Hey, you new? I've never seen you here before. How's it going? Let me help you with the coffee. Yeah, I'll take the trash out. Let's clean this place up. For an hour and a half, I am just floating. You know, the light shines. You know? Fact of the matter is, it's what I do when I leave here. This is a much more important, demonstration lies in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs. It's what I do when I take these principles outside into the world, because I only spend about an hour and a half a day at most in an AA meeting. What am I doing when I'm at the grocery store and that person takes that spot that I was actually hoping to get? You know, what do I do on the 405 when that one person decides to get one car leg ahead of me? You didn't even use your signal. That's how you communicate on the road. As I mentioned, I've been given a set, like a daily reprieve is what the book says, and I can choose to pick up some books during the day, talk to something greater than myself, which I really don't understand. It talks about a God as you understand him. For me, it's, I don't really get it. I believe in something, and the closest I've come to understanding that, there was a guy, Craig O, who I heard speak early on when I was new, and he said, things work out best for people who make the best of how things work out. That's God for me, you know. It all has a meaning. I don't have to get it for it not to be God. You know, I just believe. You know, I believe. And it's screwy sometimes. Sometimes the most despicable stuff happens in AA, out of AA, in the world. You know, to me, to others, to great people. And I'm not here to understand it. I really don't get it. I have a choice today. I can choose to look at it and say, this is poopy. I'm over it. SNL. Or I can say, you know what, there's an opportunity here to give back, to say thanks, and to take it with as much integrity and grace as possible, you know, and pass it on to the next person and say, hey, you know what, I've walked through some tough things. Oh, you have too? Here's what I did, and you know what, I'm still here. And not only am I still here, I'm still sober. One more day. It's all I got. You know? And my motives, a lot of the times my motives don't have to be hid. At the gym, I don't know if you guys go to the gym. Bill the boss, feeling it. What's up, man? My head tells, I'm a little guy. I'm a pill. I've actually gained 50 something pounds in sobriety. If you can find it, I will give you money. At the gym, my head will tell me because I'm so scrawny that no matter how much I lift and work out, that I'll never get big. Or like you might be on the other end, you might say I'll never lose the weight, or whatever it is that your head says. My head tells me all sorts of crazy stuff about me, and I'll just use the gym. This is pointless. There's no point in me doing this. I feel as if it's not going to work. But if I keep working out, I will get stronger, despite what my head says and what I feel. And that's Alcoholics Anonymous for me. I can have the wrong motives and take the right action, and good things still happen. You know, and I learn as time goes on that I do this because I love it. You know, it's a responsibility, but with that comes a great freedom, and I love Alcoholics Anonymous for that. It has given me a life that I enjoy today, that I love just the way it is, as it is. And I hope you find that fun. Thank you.
Thanks, Richie. All right, now at this time, I would like to introduce Erica from West Hills.
I'm Erica, an alcoholic. Okay. What time is it? Got it. Hi, everybody. Thank you so much to the other panelists and to come, and thank you so much for asking me to be here. It's always great to participate in my sobriety, and it's neat being in a room full of young people and people who got sober young. You know, I got here when I was in my teens, and it was one of those things that allowed me to feel different from everyone else for so long. So it's always nice to be in a room of other people that have been through that as well. My whole story is really just, my family was better than some and worse than others. It really wasn't what made me an alcoholic. It wasn't what made me drink the way that I ended up drinking. What did that for me was the fact that I had this head that would not shut up. And from the earliest time I can remember, it just went and went and went and went. And it was always, I wasn't pretty enough, I wasn't skinny enough, I wasn't tall enough, I wasn't smart enough, I never said the right thing. What I said always sounded weird, if I always get uncomfortable, and then I wouldn't want to talk, and I wasn't saying anything. And, you know, and it just went and went and went. And I, from as soon as I can remember, I just wanted it to be quiet. And when I was really little, it started off with reading books. I'd read books like it was a phone drug. I just wanted to check out on books. And then I got into sports, and I could check out that way. And by the time I was 10, those things weren't working anymore. And I found alcohol. And I don't know what made me start drinking at that age. I don't know where I got the idea that that's what was going to fix it. But my motive for drinking in the beginning was really just to shut my head up. Just long enough so I could take a deep breath and lay my head down on the pillow and go to sleep at night. Because it just ran all the time, and it was exhausting, and, you know, my story is really that, you know, I started drinking alcoholically from the get-go. I started the way a lot of people stop. I started by myself in my room all day long, you know, and driving myself crazy with alcohol, and, by the time I was 12, it was entirely out of control, and I went into my first institution at 12, and I learned about a lot of really cool drugs, and then I got out and tried them. And, you know, when you get so young, it's easier to get drugs than it is to get alcohol. It's a lot easier. And so I did a lot of drugs, and I didn't like the uppers, I liked the downers, I liked the things that made me go to sleep. And I liked the stuff that turned my head off, And that's the way it went. You know, as I got older and as I progressed in my disease, I started drinking more like the other kids my age. I started drinking to fit in because all of a sudden, you know, now it's about what you think of me, and now it's about being like part of a crowd, and now it's about like fitting in middle school and fitting in with the other kids, and I don't fit in with the good kids, and I don't fit in with the really popular fun kids, so I fit in with the bad kids. I fit in with the kids that came from other weird homes and the kids that did other things, and you know, and it got out of control, and my drinking towards the end was back the way it started. It was drinking to just shut my head off again, and I didn't care I realized I was never going to feel comfortable with you guys whether I was drunk or not, so I just wanted to drink enough so I didn't care what you guys thought anymore about me. And you know, by the time I'm 16 years old, the men in the coats take me out of bed and they take me into the rehab, and I'm tired and I'm done. And you know, and I come in Alcoholics Anonymous at 16 years old, and this is not really what I had in, what I had planned. And I didn't understand. You know, I think I was so just so crazy that I didn't get that there was things that we really needed to do around here at that point in time. I had heard, like, you know, you just drink and don't use no matter what, and you show up to meetings and then things get better. So I just didn't drink and use, and I showed up to meetings, and I wondered, well, started to wonder why I was still, you know, behaving really, really badly and doing things that made me uncomfortable. And, you know, and when you don't work a program in Alcoholics Anonymous, my experience is that you behave badly in these rooms. And for me, because I care what you think about me, because I care whether or not I'm being approved of, you know, I'll leap over that. And I behaved badly in the rooms, and people started to judge me, and so I walked away, because I would rather suffer alone and away, and I'd rather drink than feel uncomfortable. Because that's why I drank in the first place. I just didn't want to feel uncomfortable. And when it wasn't when I made Alcoholics Anonymous no longer a safe place, I left. And, you know, my relapse was short, and I came back, it was short, and it was rough. I mean, it took me about a week to get to where I left off, and, you know, I'm one of those drunks that, you know, I want you to feel bad for me. I want you to look at me and be like, for her, she, you know, she's so tragic. It's so rough being her. And, you know, and like the big book talks about, I put myself in positions to be hurt. And when I drink, I put myself in positions to be hurt physically. And, you know, I also have some issues with rage. And so I'd end up drunk in places and picking fights with people I had no business picking fights with. And I can't fight. I can't fight at all. I just get beat up. And, you know, and so it got real rough real quick. And so when I come back here, and I'm 19 years old, and I'm angry because this is not where I'm supposed to be, and this is not what I want, you know, I was angry, but I was done, and I was willing. And I could, and I didn't understand, I kind of put together the fact that certain things were optional. I didn't put together the fact, like, you know, when people make these suggestions, I didn't really understand that that was up for debate or anything like that, so I just did what I was told, and I showed up to the meetings I was told to go to, and I took the commitments I was told to get, and I, you know, and I did what you guys told me for, you know, that's just the way I started, and I got to, you know, I got to get some clean time together, and for me, sobriety comes... My sobriety goes in, like, cycles of every 3 years. You know, my first 3 years was all just about getting sober and getting some time put together. And then, you know, I hit three, and all of a sudden I realized, you know, just because I have some time doesn't make me any better. And I'm still behaving crazy in the rooms. I'm still doing all the things I was doing while I was loaded. I just wasn't drinking. You know, I wanted to come here, and I wanted to get better, but I didn't want to do the work. And in doing so, I sort of woke up a couple years in sobriety and realized that my life was completely out of control. And everyone I was around was completely insane, because I wasn't hanging out with you. I was just showing up to your meetings and then leaving and going and doing my own thing. Because as long as I didn't drink and use, then I thought I was going to be okay. You know, and I had a friend's mom who actually called me out on it once. I had one of my best friends that I would pal around with all the time, and he was a complete and total lush, and I had probably about 2.5 years sober, but I'd still, like, drive him everywhere. And I'd, you know, and I tell myself, oh, you know, I'm going to, my motives are to, you know, make sure that people get from point A to point B, you know, okay, and everyone is safe. And in truth, my matter was to steal some vicarious pleasure from everyone else's drinking and from everyone else doing what they were doing. And you know, and I remember very clearly when I brought him home belligerent one more time and rolled him out of my car one more time and dragged him up the driveway to his mom's house one more time, and she's like, why do you do this? You encourage him. know, and she called me out on my behavior and the fact that I was not helping a situation, but that I was really just behaving one more time like a drunk without drinking. And, you know, that's where I go without a program of alcohol, without working the actual program. I mean, I can sit in here and I can go to the meetings, but it doesn't mean I'm working a program. And, you know, it was a combination of his mom saying that and a lot of people I was hanging out with dropping dead within a matter of a couple of months. And I sort of got another one of those rude awakenings at 3 years of sobriety where something had to give and something had to change. And, you know, I was, I recently switched sponsors because my current original sponsor had moved. And, you know, and the sponsor I got at that time was really into the book. And I was going to a book study where they get really, really into the book, and she took me through and showed me how to find my solution in the Good Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she taught me that, you know, opinions are opinions, and what I'm sharing with you right now is my opinion, but my answer is in the Good Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she showed me how to go through the columns and get clear on what my motives were, and how to, you know, see my part and move forward and find the fact that, like, oh, you know, when I'm, you know, in a fight with this person because I want them to do something, because I'm trying to control the situation, you know, I have a part in these things. And there were instances in my life and instances, you know, some of these tragic events that I thought had happened to me when I really found out that I was not quite the victim that I really would like to have believed I was. And, you know, in doing the call work and in learning more about myself, you know, I got to get clear on some of that, and I got to find out what my problem was. My problem was that I was self-righteous, and that I wanted to be right more than I wanted to be happy, and that I would walk over anyone in order to get what I felt I needed, and that I had these fears. You know, you guys told me about these fears, and the 12 and 12 talks about these fears, and the, you know, at the end of the day, my fear is I'm going to lose what I have or not get what I want. And when you give me those two options, I will do anything to hold on to what I want, you know, and I will run over whomever I feel that I need to run over to get it. And, you know, and my motives, I learned that there were solutions in order to change those behaviors. And I learned that there was a contrary action that I could take in order to move past, kind of review everything and move forward with it in step 6 and 7. And I didn't understand for a long time how that really worked. You know, it was explained to me that step 6 and 7 were to not do what you want to do and to do what you don't want to do, and to change the behavior in that way to move forward. And, you know, I hit about, God, I must have been maybe 6 or 7 years sober, and I realized that just being aware of all this stuff was not going to fix me. You know, it was a huge, huge, huge disappointment that just being aware was not going to fix me. And, you know, and the people around Alcoholics Anonymous told me I had to get a God, and that was very disappointing. Because I really thought that all this I had done up to this point on my own. I had been perseverance, and I had fixed it, and I had done the work, and, you know, I had written my columns, and I had gained my knowledge, and that should be enough to move forward on. But, you know, you guys told me that I needed to have a God so that way I feel safe to let go of some of those character defects. You know, it talks about how my character, you know, I think it's in this 12 also, where it talks about how my character defects are my best resources of getting my needs met. You know, so I had to find that God, and I had to find a trust that there was something that was not me, and that there was something that was bigger than me, and that there was something that maybe knew a little bit better. For a long time it was the group. For a really long time it was the group. It was the entity of Alcoholics Anonymous that was obviously bigger than me and had a solution that I didn't know what it was, and if I came to you guys, you could give it to me. And that was it for a really, really, really long time, and it evolved from there. But, you know, And it's a gift to have a God in my life today, I have to say. And, you know, probably about, like I said, my sobriety seems to go in cycles of three. And when I hit nine, I realized that just having a God and just having done that writing wasn't going to be enough. And I really, really needed to change the way I was behaving. And I really needed to do things differently and to get some real, to really feel clean with the way I was behaving, and I had to make another change and really get into those steps 6 and 7 where I do make the changes. Because it's easy enough for me to look at myself. I'm perfectly fine with telling you guys my deepest, darkest secrets, but if you want me to change my behavior, that is an entirely different story. I'm not okay with that. It's hard, and it's scary. And, you know, that was... And that's where I am today. You know, I'm a little over 10 years sober, and today it's about acting differently than I feel, and it's about behaving better than I want to, and it's about showing up when I really don't feel like it, and it's about, you know, it's about being of service when I'd much rather do my own thing, and the gifts that I get from that, I never would have imagined. You know, if you told me that this is what my life would be like when I was 19 years old and I was pissed and sitting in a corner, I would not have believed you. I would not have believed you. But, you know, the gifts that I've gotten here, I can't even put it into words. It's just been, it's been amazing. And I've learned that I can start over and I can sort of hit my reset button, as I heard it say earlier, you know, any point in time. I don't have to drink anymore in order to start over and to get fresh and to make a change in my life. I don't need that to cause the huge upheaval that I used to. You know, and I truly, you know, I'm just grateful today. And I think that's really all I have, so thank you.
Thanks, Erica. All right, our last panelist, I'd like to introduce Jimmy C. from...
Saurita.
Welcome, my name is Jimmy, and I'm an alcoholic.
Jimmy!
Everybody says, where are you from? I said, oh, just a little bit south of Tucson. Because Saurita is hard to especially pronounce if you read it. So I talked with some of my friends and I have this little side joke that it's funny because my wife always gets asked to be like that speaker and that person to come and talk and be the spiritual whatever. And they said, Jimmy, can you talk to me now? I said, sure, what's the topic? Depends on us and our motives. First, you know, I tell everybody, it's like, what are they trying to say? And then really inside I'm like, how did they know? You know, so I got sober when I was 19 years old, it's a tricky topic. You know, they pulled this out of a big book in the sexual inventory, and it talks about our sexual ideal, and if we fall short, are we to drink? And it says some say so, but it depends on us, our motives, and. Something like that. I just read it not too long ago, so that's how I know it. I was told I'm not allowed to memorize the big book because I don't do a very good job at it, and when I think I'm memorizing something, then I go and tell you that that's what it is, and many times it's not. And, there's one motive that I try to live by on a regular basis, and it, you know, a lot has been talked, and it wasn't all about the sexual inventory, and I think that point is pretty prevalent here. And the 11th step says I seek through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God, praying only for knowledge of His will for me and the power to carry that out. And that's what I try to keep as a motive, like in everything that I do. My current sponsor tells me, you know, do you pray for your kids to be healthy? For you to have food on the table, you know, roof over your head. And I go, yeah. And he's like, why? don't you think God already knows that? Like, don't you think that that's what God would want for you and your kids and everyone as well? Like, happiness and joy and the freedom, and like, if that's what he wants, why don't I just pray for whatever, you know, to know what God wants and the power to carry that out? That's all I need to worry about. You know? I remember 6 years sober, I was living in Sacramento, and I was having some issues because I didn't get this. You know, motives weren't there, you know, when I got sober. I had lots of wonderful ideas and these motives to do good and be good, and all of that stuff went out the window. And it's not like I consciously said, I'm going to drink instead of that. I'd drink and then I'd cross over, I'd walk and trample on all these beliefs and lines that I had. And, you know, I had to create... I did a lot of action in my life, especially when I was drinking and using, that I don't know why I did it. I had no motive behind any of it. But I have to create reasons for why it was that I did it so that it would be okay. You know? Like, and to the extent that when I got here, like, I had such severe drug-induced schizophrenia, I couldn't talk because I had this whole other world that I had now created, based off of why it was, things were the way they were, and why my dad was around, blah, 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 blah. So that stuff had to start slowly being instilled on me, that I could find a purpose or a reason to put one foot in front of the other, and when I put one foot in front of the other, that purpose was accomplished. And I had to cast away, as it says in the, you know, in the big book, of just emotional rearrangements and displacements. That's how they describe that spiritual experience, and where these men take these old ideas and set them aside and refill them with these new ideas. And that's it's been constant. You know, my new ideas, that like learning how to brush my teeth and not doing things that gave me scabs and lice and scabies and crabs and all that stuff, like, you know, taking showers and like all that stuff. But those were great new ideas, and they were wonderful. And there were some other new ideas that weren't all that great, you know. And some of those new ideas stopped working after some time, and I had to go through this emotional rearrangement. Sober, you know, like, no, it wasn't drinking. I had to go through this spiritual awakening and a spiritual experience of getting rid of these old ideas, the ones that didn't work, and putting in new ideas. And 6 years sober, I was talking to a lady that had a lot more time than me in Sacramento, and I was in awe because I was sober and alcoholics, friends, doing everything so great, and I didn't understand why people still gave me some of those looks as if I was like just burned them, you know, and I didn't get it, and you know. My best example of that is like going to somebody's house to say, hey, can you come over and help me with the furniture? You know, I need to paint and all this stuff. And I get there and they're not there, and there's this beautiful like dresser there, and I think, oh, great. So you sand it and you paint it, and you pull up in the driveway and you're like, what are you doing? I'm helping you paint and the furniture. I'm like, my great grandma gave me that. You know, and I'm wondering why they're pissed off because I went there and my intention was to be of service and to help out, and they're pissed at me, and I'm like, screw this, this is stupid. You know, why am I even doing it? And I didn't get that, and she put me back into those 60s pages, you know, where it says that I'm, even at my best, I'm a producer of confusion and not harmony. You know, that's good or bad, you know. And she told me to read in those 60s and leave out all the bad stuff, you know, like, sometimes I don't know, you have to open the book and read it. If I had it, I'd read it to you right now. But it was, you know, sometimes we're kind and loving and, you know, gracious and blah, 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 all this wonderful stuff. And then we wonder how, like, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. And we're like, what? I was kind and generous. And my motives were good, and I still am causing harm because I'm trying to make you live life the way I think you should live life, instead of letting you live life the way you're supposed to live life. And so the motives games like I'm tired now, sober, of trying to do the motives games and really not turn my, you know, character defects over the power within myself. And so it's simple. It's back to being simple for me. It's, you know, praying every day and trying to make that be my motive, and I put one foot in front of the other, and, you know, a lot, and I, over time, you start seeing stuff in hindsight, you know, like, oh, crap, you know, I walked off that curb and I didn't cry, or, you know, I actually helped that newcomer somehow, and I don't know how I got, you know, there was no way, and I took him to a meeting, and he's cool, you know, and I never saw that stuff, you know, and I look back on it now, and I, That's all I know, you know. I know that I get up in the morning and I do what I'm supposed to do. The only way you learn how to date is you date, you know. That's how you learn how to date. If you're sober and you're thinking about dating, date. It'll either suck or it'll be great. And if it sucks, date differently, you know. Like, and I think that's where the basis is around all that stuff. I've been around Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've done it myself, where I step on the toes of my fellows and they retaliate, whether I'm being bitter and harsh or loving and kind when I step on their toes. If that doesn't affect me, if I'm not wondering, like, you know, oh, that really sucked that I stepped on their toes and it hurts me that I stepped on their toes and I need to do something different so I don't do it again, yeah, I could probably drink it. So what I do is I consistently do what they told me when I was new. Like, all I have to do is apply 12 steps. If I worry about anything else, like Paul H. for 25 years, then I had to say it just because that name came up again, so I had to say it against the podium, right? On the tape, I think. So I stay surrendered and surrounded, and I do the work that the people that came before me told me to do. And if it doesn't turn out the way that feels good, that makes me happy, joyous, and free, if I start feeling restless, irritable, and discontent, which I know is what leads me to the drink, I've done something that didn't work. And I need to... If I'm not surrounded and surrendered to that fact that I have conceded my innermost self that I'm an alcoholic, and because of that I'm screwed, I can't manage my life ever, I need a God to do that, and I also need other alcoholics around me to do that, there's nobody for me to turn to and say, I don't get it, you know, like, let's play this out and see what we did and try and find out. Like, most of the stuff that happens in my life has nothing to do with the situation, like this deeper core stuff that's involved in some of my motives, you know, that I didn't, most of the time, didn't even know was there. You know, and so unless I have somebody to keep digging with, there's no way I'm ever going to change that. And for me, when I was drinking, I'd feel that, and I'd drink. And it slowly got deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper until it was, you know, it was AA or, you know, going on miserably and hopefully die. You know, because, yeah. So I don't, you know, the fact that people come into a motives panel is awesome, you know. I hope that if you aren't surrounded, that you get surrounded and you find not people that have what you want, but truly, truly enjoy what they have. Because that's where it is, you know. I need to do everything I can to get rid of the riz. And if I apply the principles behind the riz being restless, irritable, and discontent, if I apply the principles behind the steps, I don't feel restless, irritable, and discontent. A lot of stuff happens in life. You know, people pass away. I'm going to share this just because. My wife's sister had a baby, but it didn't develop properly in the womb, and so it passed away this morning, 6 weeks old. And its internal organs weren't processing, and they did a bunch of surgeries, and there was lots of hope, and everything seemed to be all right. And then this morning, she passed away, 6 weeks old. And like, there's some preciousness to like just life, you know. And for me to get caught up in all the BS that happens, like, we're here, man. Get surrounded. It's the only place that people really care about my ass more than my face, despite what I think sometimes. You know, and God's got a purpose. What it is, I don't know. Sometimes he's humorous, sometimes doesn't really seem that way. But there are four people here. People that are here that when they do something wrong, they really feel it themselves. You know, and they want that to change. And if that's what you want, people, I mean, they'll lay down a lot of stuff in order to help you do that. And that's what I found. Like, I've done a lot of damage sober, trying to do what I thought was best for me and for you. And I've had to make amends for sober actions, and I'm still here, you know, like, that's the biggest deal, you know, I don't know, I'm, you know, it's cutting it short, but I'm grateful to be here, you know. Don't get stuck on your motive. There's a bigger thing than you that can take care of that stuff. I was talking to a friend of mine about the onion that they talk about, and oh, it's like peeling an onion, and I pictured, like, the produce store, and this onion. For some reason, mine's always a yellow onion. I don't know why. But a yellow onion, you know, and that's it. And so, I have to rationalize, like, everything. But now that I've gotten sober, like, the peels are still the same, like, thickness as that onion. But I'm like, damn, I didn't say it was that big of an onion. You know, I have, like, this prize award-winning onion. So, like, I'm doing lots of stuff, you know? I have a 10-year-old boy and a 5-year-old boy, and I'm having to deal with some of my mom's stuff, you know? It's a reason for me to definitely, you know, I see it, and I'm like, I'm so sorry, Mom. I didn't mean any of it. But they bring out a lot of that stuff, you know? And I surround, you know, God has a way of putting people in your lives and situations in your life. Not necessarily, I don't think it's about testing my motives, but it's about allowing me to be human, that human condition, that imperfection, where spirituality, I think, is found, you know, and that's all this is about, you know, like, come outside, if you smoke, have a cup of coffee, hang out, you know, like, life happens, and I want to hear about it, and I think other people want to enjoy what it is that we do, you know, and, I don't have much more than that. Thank you very much.